Greetings, everyone. It is now time for Marked Safe. Tales of your very favorite and most beloved disasters. On Marked Safe, we discuss events and details that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Please listen responsibly and stay safe. And now, here with your hosts, Brianne and Melanie, this is Marked Safe.
Hey, buddy.
How about that moon?
How about that moon?
It was a little out of hand.
I think so.
Did you like it? How much totality did you have?
Okay, so I think we were sitting at 82%, but we had storms roll in. And originally the plan for us was to go to Aunt Carolyn and Uncle Jim's house in Hot Springs because they were 100% totality, which would have been super cool on the river. Mm-hmm. But just because of life and we've dealt with a lot of sicknesses this year, we are literally like close to tapped out on absentees at school. Because here's the thing. I got four kids in the same school. If one of them gets sick, the rest of them are getting sick. But I'm not taking them all to the doctor because they've got the same bullshit. No, and they're usually ridiculous. Not getting medicine. So one kid will get a note and the rest of them, it's unexcused. You know what I mean? And they send those letters home saying that they're going to take you to court after like the third one. And
oh, God.
It's just so my anxiety
it's
cannot.
So threatening.
It is so threatening and I cannot handle it. And so I was like, they were on spring break and then they went back the day of the eclipse. And I'm like, I don't want to push it. We've got like 7 weeks left. Who knows what's going to happen? Let's pocket our days. So 82% here. The kids, they did the whole eclipse thing at school. They gave everybody in their classes glasses. They went outside for it. It was nothing. It was just a normal day here. Nothing happened.
Oh.
It was boring.
I'm sorry. That sounds like kind of a bummer.
It was a bummer.
Well, okay. We did make a whole thing of it. Schools in the area were canceled. We were in the path of totality. So we got our eclipse glasses and set up like a picnic type situation in the back and kind of just sat out there all day, took a bunch of pictures, took a time lapse, like I don't know. We went to Sonic and got solar blackout slushes or whatever they were calling them. Yeah, it was fun. I will say that everyone, I haven't heard anyone else say this, so we're probably stupid, but everyone in my household was like, I thought it would be a little bit darker.
Yeah.
Because it really wasn't like nighttime. It was like a very weird, desaturated, dim light, but it was not the same as nighttime. So I don't know. It was very interesting. I swear to God, I feel like the one in 2017 was darker, but it was really cool. And then it was over and, everybody took naps.
I think it's okay to, you know, complain about the eclipse.
I would give it 4 out of 5 stars. could have been darker. Mildly overhyped, still fun, worth the money, which was like $8 at Sonic.
I did see this post where a science teacher years and years and years ago, his first year of teaching, told his science class that.
They should come celebrate with him. And then they did.
Yes. And he told his classes like every year until this past eclipse. And he thought maybe a couple would reach out and like over 100 people showed up to his house to watch the eclipse with their teacher.
I love that. I'm kind of wanting more wholesome eclipse stories. So if anybody has heard any, it doesn't have to be yours. I don't know. There was one picture of a guy holding
up
a fish.
It doesn't have to be mine.
No, I mean anybody. Like
rude.
People. I want of people, if you've heard a wholesome eclipse story, even if it didn't happen to you, you just read it on the internet somewhere, tell it to me because I really want to know. And trust me, we're going to need it next week. So if you've seen any wholesome eclipse stories, let us know. I saw a picture of a guy who was holding up a fish, like a fish you'd catch in a lake. And he was holding it up to the sky and he had put eclipse glasses on the fish to check out the eclipse. Meanwhile, he is looking directly at it with nothing on his face. Maybe that's not wholesome, but it is chaotic. So I'll take that too.
Survival of the fittest. Survival of the fishes.
Oh, Melanie. I love you so much.
Oh, well, should we jump into this week's bracket?
Yes, please. I'm so prepared.
I am so proud of you because you did homework this
week. I did. I cooked homework. And you know what? I did more than that. I also made the other one. Because, I mean, I've had it before, but I was like, but is it fresh in my mind at all? Let's just have it again.
Yeah. So Monte Cristo versus Nutella and bananas.
Okay. So Nutella and bananas is one of those things where it's like, I've had lots of Nutella banana things, and I've had sandwiches with similar ingredients, but have I definitely ever actually had that specific sandwich? I don't know. My imagining of it was very accurate, so probably. So I did make one of those, and then I made, well, before that, actually, I made a Monte Cristo, which was an adventure for me. And if you're not familiar, it's basically like a grilled cheese, but you add ham, maybe turkey, depends on the recipe. I was going to add both, but I am a dipshit, so I bought two packages of ham instead. Basically a grilled cheese with ham on it. And the bread is made of French toast and then like fried and then powder sugared and then dipped in raspberry jam, which I liquefied for a more dippy consistency. And I will tell you, the whole house loved them. I was surprised all around.
Before you tell me what your choice is, do you think this pairing was good?
What do you mean by good?
Like, I really like matching these different
sandwiches. I know. No, they made sense together.
Okay. That's
what. Yeah.
No, they did. This one kind of gave me a little bit of pause. So.
No, you're fine.
I appreciate the feedback.
And they were both worthy contenders. I will say that I think I'm going to pick the Monte Cristo because it was a little bit more novel of a flavor profile. I feel like there's a lot of banana Nutella shit in the world, and it's delicious, don't get me wrong. But I could get that same flavor combination eating lots of things. Monte Cristo is kind of unique, actually. I was not expecting to like the sweet and savory quite as much as I did. I thought it would be heavier than it was, and it was kind of heavy, but you know, now and then. And the raspberry did lighten it up, so I loved it
because it's got that tart to it.
Yeah all three of us actually really liked it. I might even make it again sometime. Which I was definitely not expecting.
Well, there you have it. Monte Cristo wins this week.
All right. Well, hope we've had a good top of the episode 9 minutes, because it's all downhill from here.
It is all downhill from here.
Oh, my God.
You told me what you were going to do, and
I have never. This episode broke me, Melanie. I'm not going to lie.
I'm really glad that you gave me the heads up, because
this is, first of all, the only one that I've ever truly felt like I needed to pre-content warning you and make sure you were okay with hearing this.
Yeah, it was really good to be as much of a headspace as you can be.
There are a couple topics where if you were doing them, maybe I would rather you didn't, because I don't think that's good for me. So I needed to run this by you, which is not really normally something that I do. This is the only episode that I have ever not been able to simplify even a little bit for Adelaide. Like, not even the kid version. There is none. And this is the only episode I have ever done where, until the very morning of recording, I have been on the fence about scrapping the entire thing. I have a lot of feelings about this episode. I think the only other episode I've had this many feelings and opinions and emotions about was the Hart family. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, it is more difficult than that episode. Although there are no kids in peril, I need to give constant content warnings throughout this almost. You need to check the content warnings, but I'm really going to cover it here when I say that this entire episode is about suicide in a very, very in-depth way.
Yes.
This is entirely about mental illness, and I also want to point out that it is maybe just to me. I don't know if this is a me thing or if other people are going to have the same reaction, but to me, this is the decline and death of someone that I very, very, very strongly relate to. And I feel like seeing it go down that road when it's someone that you could relate to is a much bigger trigger than it would be otherwise. Fortunately for me, suicide is not a significant trigger that I have, or I would never have been able to do this episode. But hearing it happen in, you know, somebody who seems very different from your peer group, have nothing in common with you, it's like, wow, that's really tragic. But seeing and understanding and relating to steps 1 through 8, when step 10 is what it is terrifying.
Right.
But she is a person that I think a lot of us will relate to. So please, please use the utmost care in deciding whether to engage with this episode. I hope that this is our poorest listen to episode. I hope we do the worst numbers we've ever done, because the most people should be skipping this episode.
Right.
So I hope the numbers line up. And if you would like to dip out now, please do so. All the small talk is over. We're going to get into it now. And this is the heaviest episode I have ever done. I had the privilege to meet two different very engaged listeners this month for two completely different reasons.
So amazing.
Yeah. I got to meet Riley, and then I got to meet Stephanie, and they're both magical.
Yeah, just they are.
Absolutely people that you would want to know. And while I was having dinner with Riley, she brought up this story. And I was like, oh, wow, that sounds interesting. You know, maybe I don't think I've ever even heard of that. Maybe I should check into that at some point. Maybe I'll do like a compilation. This is, you know, this could be a compilation, pretty heavy, but maybe. And then I started researching the story a little bit, and it had me by the throat and never let go. So, this was a listener suggestion. It is, Jesus Christ. I didn't want to tell this to be honest. Like, I am stalling at this point, and I don't have time. We're on a deadline right now. Okay. So, this is the story about a Virgo from Ohio. But you gotta hear me out, because she is cool. Christine was born in August of 1944 in Hudson, Ohio, to 23-year-old housewife Peg and 26-year-old salesman George, joining their son Tim. Greg followed soon after, completing the family of five. She attended Laurel School for Girls, and Christine was striking in many ways from an early age. By age 13, one source said 5'11", one source said 5'9". Either way, she was a tall woman and had arrived at her peak, literally and figuratively height-wise, by age 13. Which is one of those things that 30-year-old women are like, oh, she's so cool. But 13-year-old girls don't think so.
Right.
That is really looked at differently depending on who's looking at it.
Especially during that time frame.
Yes, exactly. I think that is the tragedy of the story for me, is that there's so much about her that would be received so differently now. And she was not without support, not without understanding. But I think that it would have turned out differently for her now. And that's awful. Mm-hmm. As she came into her own, she was just beautiful. She had gorgeous features, very, very long, dark, shiny hair. That did not translate to dating success for her, though, at all. She had an inherent difficulty in getting close to people romantically. She just didn't seem to read the room with men. She wanted to. She very much wanted a romantic partnership, very much. But somehow she put them off. And I'm not saying that to be any type of way. That is just how it was. She had a very particular personality, and a lot of people, but definitely a lot of men, didn't connect with it easily. It took a certain sort of person to get Christine. While she was in school, she created the tongue-in-cheek Dateless Wonder Club for herself and other girls who never had a date on the weekends. She did well academically, and after graduating high school at Laurel, she went to Miami of Ohio for 1 year, majoring in theater, where she discovered a talent for acting, then switched to Endicott Junior College, and finished at Boston University with a degree in broadcasting. After she graduated from college, she returned home to Ohio. She very briefly dipped her toes into the dating pool when she was 21, but her dad had a big issue with the age gap between her and the guy. He was in his 30s, she was 21, so she ended it and she didn't date again. At some point, Peg and George, Christine's parents, got divorced. They owned a beachside cottage in Siesta Key, and Peg moved into it after the divorce, joined by a rotating combination of her three children.
Of Peg's children?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Throughout her life, Christine experienced what, from what I can gather, treatment-resistant depression, and she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Her fight with her mental health really did take over her life, but it wasn't for lack of support. Her parents had money, and they saw helping Chris with her struggles as a fine way to spend it, to the tune of nearly $1 million, quote, helping Chrissy find peace.
Wow.
Yeah. Her brother Greg said, "My mom would try to help her, and I would do what I could do. My grandparents would do what they could, and she would come out of it, and she would be better, and we would think with all the outside help with the professionals, maybe this would be the time that she would get her wind and be fine. But it just never really happened completely for her. It's a really sad, tragic circumstance." In the early 70s, Christine attempted to die by overdosing on pills while she was living in Boston, but she did survive. And her family swooped in to try to kind of usher her away to new surroundings for a fresh start. Christine was well described by many people, and she had such a nuanced and distinctive personality that it's not she lit up the room generic bullshit. There is a lot of much more substantial and descriptive information about her out there. And if you assemble the ways that she was described, you kind of feel like you knew her. And it's not just that. Here's the thing. There's a movie about her called Christine. There's another about someone kind of getting into method acting to play her. But the one that I watched is called Christine. It's on Prime. It's one of the best movies that I think I've ever seen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Like top 10, I would say. And somewhere in all that, I realized she reminds me of myself and she reminds me of you in a certain way. Like, she would be the third host on this podcast because she had the exact same journalistic vision. She felt overwhelmingly strongly about keeping everything that she did victim-focused. And she felt overwhelmingly strongly about doing slightly weird, quirky, take people out of their comfort zone, get right into the viewer's face kind of stuff. She wanted to do things that would take you inside in a way that you would never normally.
I love that so much.
Yes. And she felt very strongly about it. And she was born in 44. My grandmother was born in 46. She reminds me a lot of her, and my grandmother has always talked to me about how she, felt very separate and different at that age. When to me she wasn't, but that's probably because I am too. And it was always so hard for me to understand, but then I recognized a lot of her in Christine, and I was like, oh, that's what she meant. I get it. I feel like in the movie, at least, which is very well researched and very true to the story, can't diagnose this woman after the fact. I'm going to say at the very least, she is very heavily coded in the movie as autistic.
Yeah.
Very heavily. So that is probably part of why I'm like, wait, hold on. This is one of us. Very bright student. She became a nationally ranked kayaker at 16. She had a deep love of language from early childhood. She would make up words for things that didn't have names per family. She was extremely problematically self-deprecating. She was a scuba diver. Jean, one of her co-workers at the station, said she did not like the unexpected. She insisted on being well-prepared at all times. She loved beachcombing. A friend said she was a wonderful person, very brilliant, but never terribly happy. She loved Roberta Flack. A co-worker said she was a very nice girl, outspoken on some things, very liberal on some things. She's an easy person to get along with and is just like one of the guys. And I do want to point out that I feel like there are quite a few people who say that she's like them. And that makes me feel like she got very good at masking.
Yeah.
And I feel like that would be, that's very interesting to imagine someone, which in my head, I'm going to consider her some form of neurodivergent. I cannot be clear enough that the only thing I know she was actually diagnosed with is bipolar. This is purely my speculation, but it is very interesting to imagine why somebody who might be neurodivergent would be drawn to something like broadcasting. There's a script. There's a cadence. Mm-hmm. There are mannerisms that you can learn. I get that. So one said she was an ambitious reporter, good at her job, and liked by coworkers. Another said she was the spark plug of the office and a dynamic self-starter who never worried about long hours. And that is very easy to imagine because she was beyond passionate about journalism. One of her brothers said that she, quote, never felt like she was good enough and she was constantly doubting herself, and I mean morosely doubting herself. Her brother said she managed to be the lead in the summer play and won outstanding acting, and never once acted in a play again. She had a lot of things that she was exceptionally good at, and once she showed she could do it, she lost interest and went on to the next thing. She was a marvelous person and had this sort of dry wit about her and a bit of a sharp tongue. She never felt like she fit in, and in a sense, she never did. She was an avid supporter of environmental and conservation efforts and, quote, a unique person. She was different. It was the 70s, and we were into folk things and the earth colors, and she dressed in a bright way. I thought she was very talented, end quote.
I love that so much.
I mean, this is not some normal obituary bullshit.
Right.
This is a person. Journalist Susie Quinn wrote, she was a strange combination of someone who at once wanted, needed desperately, the support and friendship of others, and in another way rejected others out of a sense of defensive pride. Her initial image was one of a self-confident, totally contained, together young woman. She would seem haughty, distant, standoffish, really. Yet when people began to know her, she evidenced such a crying need for a completely committed relationship that it drove them away for fear that they couldn't give her what she wanted. And colleagues said, she had a protective coloration, what might appear to some to be no need for friends. I felt she was someone with very deep feelings, someone who seemed more involved with her job and with her emotions than most people seem to be. She had a little bit more depth than most people. What seemed to concern her was her involvement with the human condition. She would express a negative reaction to people and the way they treated each other. One thing about her, though, was she was always self-deprecating. Always. She seemed so hangdog that I'd always compliment her purposefully, and she'd always put down the compliment.
That is rough.
It is. Her mom said, there was a haunting melody in Chris. She gave so many presents, spent so much money, not to buy their friendship, but because she wanted to. It's almost like life was a little out of gear with other people. She was the only person I ever knew who would walk into a room and every head would turn. Yet, nobody ever came over and asked for her phone number. It's been like that since she was 13, end quote. Chris was described as having a bizarre sense of humor. She very much sought out friendship and companionship, but sometimes didn't know how to respond when she received it, and could be brusque and defensive in response to kindness. But despite her struggles, she was loved and valued by a lot of people around her. Her brother Greg said, my family adored my sister. She was an interesting, gifted, flawed person. She was flawed from the time she was a little girl, emotionally flawed in many ways. Sometimes, with some of the family quotes, I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Calm down, sir. Like, we don't need to pile on how emotionally flawed she was from childhood that hard, but it's not my life, so I'm going to shut up about that, but damn. So, at 29, Christine had never had sex. And how she felt about that is hard to know for sure. It's known that she was very open about that fact with the people around her and even joked about it. In the movie, at least, in my opinion, she's very, 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 very heavily ace-coded. But being ace does not in any way, shape, or form mean that you don't need and seek out connection and understanding and intimacy and touch.
Right.
I don't know. At the very least, she had difficulty getting close to people, and there could be countless reasons why. Here's another thing. There's a lot about the story. Some of it is just, it's nobody's fucking fault. It's tragedy. This part pisses me off. So she's almost 30. The year before, she had been told that she had an ovarian cyst, leading to the removal of one of her ovaries. The fucking tragedy about this is how much less hopeless that might have felt with better medical communication, mm-hmm. because it seems like she was told that having children ever would be very difficult, if not impossible, if it wasn't done in the next couple years.
Oh, they put a timeline on
it? They did, a very short one, and she had no partner on the horizon. So she had to have felt like she was watching the possibility of everything she wanted slip through her fingers a full decade ahead of schedule.
Yeah, our biological clock is ticking early.
Going off, yes.
Yeah,
and then, it's, yeah.
You know, I know that some people still have experiences with this, but especially back then, the pressure's on. You have to get married.
Yeah.
Then you can have sex, and then you can have a baby, mm-hmm. and you have to do everything in this, like, perfect bow tie timeline.
Way. Yeah.
And then, heaven forbid, there's an age gap, too. And
right.
You know
exactly.
What I mean.
Exactly. Yes. And I do think that she did want a family completely for her own reasons very, very deeply. There are, of course, other ways to have one, but she had really wanted to have her own. And the possibility of not was very hard for her. The thing I'm mad about here is that the frequency with which I still hear women saying they have, like, PCOS or missing ovary or something, who were told by their doctors that they'd probably never have kids, is stunningly irresponsible.
Yeah.
Very often not accurate, especially because of the fact that the reason this is coming up is usually because somebody unexpectedly got pregnant.
Right.
And then, well, I was told I'd never be able to have kids. Clearly, doctors need to chill in telling people that, because a whole lot of people are hearing this. I have the exact same thing. I'm fine with talking about that. I have PCOS. I have major ovarian cysts. I have heard so many women with the exact same condition, or much milder versions of it even, being told that they were told this by their doctors. And most of the time, it's just not how reproduction works. If you are missing one ovary, you can absolutely still have kids.
I mean, that's how it is for women
I know. I mean, I'm so mad about the fact that she was told something so likely not true
yeah.
in 1974, but this still happens every minute of every day.
Yes.
And that's frustrating. People who can carry children need to be given much better information about their body's ability to conceive, whether they hope to or hope not to. But the fertility malfunction equals lifetime infertility narrative is prevalent in the U.S. on a level that is incomprehensible to me. And I will talk about this every time it comes up. I have a statistically nonsensical number of friends who have children who were told they could never have children
mm-hmm.
because of something like this. And it is so frustrating because of how much it contributed to her mindset. And it just wasn't even true. She lost one ovary. She still had the other. It's so fucking sad. So, after graduation, and in tandem with battling her mental health, Kurt spent some time promoting for a different channel and a little time co-producing a couple local shows. Then she moved to Florida to live in her parents' summer home that I mentioned in Siesta Key and get a fresh start after Boston. And then in 1973, she was hired at WXLT-TV. It was a small local station serving three counties with maybe 10,000 households viewing. it was a newer station, and it was kind of the redheaded stepchild compared to the other more successful station that Bob, the owner, had possession of. This one, the equipment was old, the staff was young, and the ratings sucked. Christine had never even been on camera before, but she started as an evening news reporter and ended up hosting a community affairs talk show called the Suncoast Digest. She was promoted to public affairs director for the station, which was not really probably as prestigious as it sounds. The money was not good. She made $5,000 a year, which in today's money is $31,000 a year.
Yikes.
Yeah. She worked very long hours doing multiple stories every day in addition to the Suncoast Digest, sometimes also doing evening news, often working weekends. She gave her life and her considerable talent to her career. A description of her show said, it will feature local people and local activities. It will give attention, for instance, to the storefront organizations that are concerned with alcoholics, drug users, and other lost segments of the community.
The Florida Man.
The Florida Man. Yes. She's one of us, Melanie. I'm telling you. This was a great fit for Chris because, like I said earlier, she was deeply passionate about victim-focused, story-based journalism. And this should have been an asset, but it wasn't. It was a massive point of contention between her and her boss. Station was tiny and the ratings were seriously struggling. So Mike, Christine's boss, was all about flashy, sensationalist, pre-clickbait, clickbait stories, basically. And Christine found that cheap, shallow, and boring. She was, quote, hardworking, diligent, and competent, and hoped to have that recognized at work. Fairly enough. It seemed like a lot of people held her in very high regard, but she was not always taken seriously by Mike in particular. And they butted heads absolutely nonstop. She hated and did not respect his voyeurism about death and gore, and he had no patience for her earnestness about journalistic integrity while their numbers were trash. And Christine persisted.
It probably didn't help that she was a woman, too. Like, you're so sensitive.
That's exactly what it was. And he called her behavior tantrums, but we'll get to that later.
Ugh, barf.
Yes, Christine persisted. She also beefed with the station owner, who said, quote, she wasn't as interested in the hard news as she was in features and didn't distinguish as she should between them. She had her own system of priorities. I asked her once to interview a prominent businessman, a restaurateur who was getting an award. She didn't do it, and I got a little uptight, and I asked the news director why. He said Chris felt her program should not be a vehicle for every commercial enterprise in the community.
Hell yeah!
Uh-huh. I explained that he was an interesting man, but frankly, I own and operate this business, and I didn't have to explain to her. End quote. Ooh. Yeah. Chris saw local issues as deeply important and relevant to listeners, and while her show was patronized at times, quote, Chubbuck took her position seriously, inviting local officials from Sarasota and Bradenton to discuss matters of interest to the growing beach community. As invested as she was in matters of importance to that growing beach community, areas like that tend to attract a certain number of very extroverted, beautiful people who just kind of feel at home in those social settings. You know what I mean? Like beach community people.
Yep. There's a very specific demographic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean the chaotic Florida Man demographic. That's a completely different thing. I mean people who have little beach parties.
Yes.
Maybe even more than in the Northeastern and Midwestern states that she'd spent most of her time in, Christine struggled socially in Florida.
I bet it was a bit of a culture shock, too.
It had to be.
They are drastically different.
Yes. Now, from what I can gather, her mom fit in immaculately in a Florida beach town. Her mom was made to be a Florida beach town lady. But Christine lived in the bougie house on the ocean in Florida that her family owned with her mom and one brother and her chocolate poodle at the time that our story becomes a thing. She was very close with her family, said they were her closest friends, even though their relationships with each other do seem messy, you know, who among us. It was not really a still living at home kind of situation, more like a long-term, intentional, more mutually respectful roommate situation, you know?
Which,
like, it wasn't like our daughter hasn't left the nest. It was like, we live together, we're all adults kind of thing.
I don't understand, like, how people get the ick from that. Like, there are so many cultures that do this.
Oh, I know.
And it's, I think, so fucking it's
ridiculous
smart.
That we don't more. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more.
I don't know. I think my kids always come up to me and, you know, they're kids. They're not going to want to live with me forever, but they, maybe they will.
You don't know.
Who knows? But they always say, no, like, I don't want to move away from you. Like, we like this dynamic. Can we? Sure. Fine. You know, but you still have, yes, to have your own life and your own things and stuff like that. But why wouldn't you want to keep your
capital hellscape? I have a capitalist hellscape. Like, why would we not be?
I mean, have you not seen the price of groceries lately?
Oh, I see it all the time. So Christine was a hobby puppeteer, and she carried her puppets in a brown bag. She volunteered with children at Sarasota Memorial Hospital, and she would bring her puppets there and perform for the kids. She drove a yellow Volkswagen Beetle. Somebody at work had said that she was one of the guys, but, like, was she? Because she dealt with a lot of misogyny and abuse at work, especially from Mike. And she was passed over for promotions, often in favor of less qualified men. And her personal life was a little dry lately. She did ask men out and go out on dates. It just literally always fizzled after one or two dates. And lately she'd been getting stood up and ghosted more and more, and it was getting to her. There was also a powder keg situation unfolding within the station. Andrea was the sports reporter, and she was very different from Chris, but they were fairly close friends. She was a few years older than her and just a natural with people, especially men, in a way that Christine was not. Both women were beautiful, but in very different ways, and Andrea probably would have been considered more so for the times. I actually think that Christine would probably fit in with a lot of people's aesthetic preferences more now, but probably not in the 70s. Andrea was petite, she was lighter complected, and she just had a buoyancy to her personality that was just out of reach for Christine. She had kind of a shake-it-off mentality. She had kind of an easy time letting go of life's problems. She remains in the world of sports broadcasting, and drawing on everything that I could dig up about her and the way she was portrayed in Christine, the one they have in Christine seems to be a composite of two characters, but I think it's almost completely based on Andrea, but I did a lot of reading about her. She seems like the kind of person who just finds life very doable. And I think that proximity to those people can be a blessing and a curse for people who don't, because sometimes someone so close but so completely removed from your experience could feel even more isolating. And I think that that happens sometimes with some of her friends. So all that aside, there was the issue of George. Gorgeous George, a handsome stockbroker who worked for the station. He may have been very handsome, but so was Christine. Looks weren't a thing that held her apart from everybody else. It was something intrinsic to her personality. But George also had a certain kind of grit, because he had also had some challenges in his life. Christine was interested in him, romantically interested in him, and she brought him cake on his birthday. Dude, this broke my heart, because I know how vulnerable that was. Yeah. I don't know how much I told you at the time. I don't know how much you remember, but it just took me back to this when my girlfriend and I were first dating. We were very, we don't want anything serious. We're just going to casually date. We're just going to have a plus one for events. It's not even that deep kind of thing. And at a certain point, I wanted it to be deeper. And my little please take me seriously heart in my hands gesture was a cake for her birthday. And I know that that was me trying to shift the tone of the relationship, and I know how vulnerable that was, and it turned out well for me. It didn't lead anywhere with Christine. What she didn't know is that Andrea, the pretty sports reporter, and George were already interested in involved with each other. And Andrea had also landed a job at a much more prestigious station in Baltimore and was leaving soon.
That's
pretty
rough.
Soon after that, she found out that George was going with her. So, I'm speculating, but I can imagine how it would feel to have somebody, and it's a friend, so you can't even hate her, like right in front of you, effortlessly landing everything that you're turning yourself inside out to swing for and miss.
Right.
So that had to be grueling. She was under the care of a psychiatrist, but everything just took a toll. People were reaching for her, but she could not see it. She saw the rejection from George, but not how badly George wanted to be her friend. He might have seemed like a bro on the surface, but he had also had some mental health stuff and suicidal feelings. George had hidden depth, and he had gotten into something called transactional analysis, which was a kind of group therapy. George had initially been very put off by Chris. He saw her as, in his own words, a liberated woman, a pain in the ass, not very attractive, almost manly. She was doing a man's job, only doing it better than a man. She was precise and efficient. There was nothing feminine about her. End quote.
Wow, that is a...
But George went to therapy, and he was doing the work on himself.
George
and
needed
the
therapy after that.
That is fair, yes. But once he broke through some of his own bullshit, he saw something of himself and Chris and respected her in a way that he hadn't before. He tried to pull her into transactional analysis too, but it didn't stick. And George, it seemed like he observed her a lot. He noticed that her two ways of being seemed to be either this hyper-professional career woman or noticeably depressed. When he realized how she looked at him, he just didn't feel like he could go there. But they had had a not very friendly relationship, and he thought she still disliked him. He wanted to be her friend. She wanted to be something else. He felt shot down as a friend. She felt shot down as a potential partner. And it is just so excruciatingly easy to see from a distance what wires got crossed and how.
Yeah.
And it's just so sad. So Christina asked Mike to let her produce a feature segment on suicide. Mike said yes. So she started researching, diligent as she always was. She reached out to the Sarasota police and spoke with a very, probably much too forthcoming police officer about how someone might do it if they were to do it. And like a shady AI bot, he described various ways to die by suicide and told her what kind of gun and bullets a person would use. He advised her on where to place the gun for maximum effectiveness, which is not where most people thought. So that's, you know, a
were
tip
her
for
questions
sure.
leading or was he?
I don't know. I could talk about the movie portrayal, but I don't know how accurate that is for that specific thing.
Wow.
Christine took notes, so she bought one. And when she mentioned it to one of her colleagues and he asked why, she said, "Well, Rob, I had this nifty idea. I thought I'd blow myself away during my talk show." He was uncomfortable, but Christine was known for her dark humor, so he laughed it off. On a Thursday, Gorgeous George saw a side of Chris that he had never met before. He said, "I went into the studio and she was flirting and, well, smug, really, almost patronizing. And she was never patronizing. She came and sat on my lap and we joked about me being horny. She was really, really together. I couldn't believe it was the same person, especially after our encounter a few weeks before. The next night, I wanted to ask her out, but her attitude was, 'Don't touch me.' I couldn't understand. I told her then, 'I really like you. I want you to know you're okay.' But she just brushed me off. I felt discounted. I felt badly about it. Now I realize that she had already made her decision to die. Her decision had been made. She'd found the answer, and she didn't need to feel afraid of me anymore." End quote.
That grosses me out. I'm sorry.
Let's unpack it.
Oh, we were talking about me being horny, so I'm going to ask her out. Like, she is so normal now.
Yeah, she turned me on once and I changed my whole mind. Never mind. Now I want to ask her out.
It's like the epitome of like thinking with your dick. It's the wrong head, bro.
It is the wrong head. I will say, I feel like for a 1974 bro, I think he did more work than a lot of them probably did. And I think that he started out seeing her. I think that a lot of men start out seeing women as either a sexual prospect or non-existent, or someone, you know, over in the non-existent box, just like negatively, very negatively. And I think that initially he saw her in that box. And then I think that he went to therapy and holy shit, wonder of wonders, started to conceptualize her as a human. And then she sat in his lap and then, yeah, thinking with my dick came back. I'm like, bro, I was almost with you. I was almost with you for a minute there.
Get it. People are complex. There's no black and white.
No, there's not. And but I think that's more important in the story than most.
I'm still grossed out.
I was very grossed out by that. I don't really think I have a final opinion on George, but the, well, I thought this and that was pretty deep and nuanced. And then I thought that and that was pretty deep and nuanced. And then I went to therapy and then she sat in my lap and I asked her out. I'm like, dude.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know. I guess also the way I have to wonder about that scenario playing out is that it's like they had a positive interaction and that I see you as a human now immediately flipped off and turned her back into a sexual object. And if she was any form of ace, I can imagine how incredibly uncomfortable that would be.
Yeah.
And why she would react so negatively. Because, I mean, yeah, you might react negatively to a dude being a creep in general, but she was very actively pursuing him, so you could also see her being interested in that. But it seems like she was very, very put off, and I don't blame
but
her.
Not if she's, like, aware enough to be like, okay, he's not into me, he's not into me, he's not into me. She comes in and she's acting like a completely different person. And he's like, oh, I mean, how would that make you feel? Like, oh,
like the broken version of you is what they want.
It's I have to pretend to be something I'm not to get.
Yes.
You. And that is a
Jesus
turn-off.
Christ. You get right to the heart of it, because that is the whole thesis of this story when we get to the end of it, which we're not going to until next week. Got a little bit more to go today, but we are going to leave it early. Yeah. I'm not surprised it landed the way it did, that's for sure.
I would be grossed out by that too. Like, you want me now? Fuck you, bro.
Yes. It seemed like she was performing and masking a lot.
And I see you now. I see you. I see you. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And therein was the problem. Mm-hmm. So on Friday, Christine hosted a party at her and her family's home with 30 guests, including many coworkers, even higher ups like Bob, the station owner, who did not like to fraternize with the staff, but he came. Everybody was surprised. A sports reporter for the network said, she didn't seem like the type to hang out, and then all of a sudden we get this invitation that she's going to have a huge party at her place. We thought, this is fantastic. She's coming out of her shell. This will be a real treat. There are a lot of examples with Christine of what was probably, especially for the times, probably very well-meaning people around her who simply did not understand what she was dealing with. A young reporter that she worked with named Craig Sager, I don't know how you pronounce it. He did go on to cover sports for CNN for decades, so I'm sure probably everyone but me knows him. Anyway, he was attending the party. Now, not all of us, but I think a fair number of us might worry a little bit if this happened. If someone who was known to be very down was suddenly and inexplicably very up.
Right.
But if catching that may be a stretch now, it certainly wasn't going to happen in 1974. Craig was at her party and said, she was having a great time. It was like, oh my God, this is such a different side of her. Once again, she's a completely different person and everybody loves it.
Ugh, so many red flags.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to leave it there for this week.
Okay.
We're going to leave that at Christine's party where she was just doing fantastic and everybody loved it. And first of all, next week we need more disaster relief.
Yes.
We need a lot. Mm-hmm. So if you guys would like to write in some disaster relief, whether it's a single item or a short story or a wholesome eclipse story, whatever it may be, please write that in and we will...
We want to hear all your good stuff.
We do.
We're going to need it next week.
We are. Because if you think this week was rough, wait till you find out about next week. So there's not really a way to provide enough disaster relief that someone who needs it, that it's going to be enough. We are going to overweight our disaster relief next week for sure. And I do have some stuff I want to talk about, a little bit of a call to action at the end of next week. But until then, this week has been so outlandishly heavy. I just want to remind anybody who needs it that in the U.S. you can call 988 to reach a suicide hotline now. In Canada, the suicide hotline is 1-833-456-4566. And if you ever just need to talk, you can reach out to us, honestly. If this episode fucked you up and you need to process, I'm sorry. And you can also reach out to my personal inbox. But I am going to link International Suicide Hotlines in the comments, because obviously we have listeners in far more places than the U.S. and Canada. So if, God forbid, anybody feels like they need that information, we want it to be very quickly accessible to you. And there is no shame in that at all. So let's do disaster relief.
Let's do disaster relief. Well, I'll go first. I went on my little mini vacation to the cabin in the woods in Mississippi, and it was glorious.
That is delightful.
We had so much fun. We brought a ton of board games. We've never really rented a cabin before. We had to bring our own linens. I, of course, forgot towels and, you know, washcloths. What else did I forget? Anything to take a shower with. We got really dirty, so the kids had to use Dawn dish soap. Brought me back to my childhood. And I read a book, Brianne.
You did read a book. You read my special book.
I read your special book after talking so much shit about
my ability to read.
Must be nice having time to read. I actually ordered your book. I took it with me on vacation and I blew through it. My kids were like, there was a little porch swing on the cabin. And the girls just sat next to me and read, too.
Oh, my God.
So you know what?
You're going to remember that forever.
I do fucking have time to read a book. And they... and it's crazy how much they notice, because they've never seen me read a book, you know, for leisure. Yeah. When they're home. I've read a ton of books for the podcast. I'm usually doing it while they're at school. But they thought it was the coolest thing, which...
Yeah.
If they're going to watch. It's kind
of contagious with Adelaide, too.
If I want them watching me do something.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what's better than reading? So.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I'm making more time for that. So thank you. I love the book. I'm
so happy to hear that.
I loved, you know, prioritizing fun stuff for me. I haven't done that in a long time.
You deserve it, babe.
I love you. What's yours?
So I'm actually just going to circle back to the fact that I got to meet Stephanie and Riley, because that was really, really cool. Really, really cool. And I don't know, I've had some good conversations, with both of them at various points, and Adelaide got to meet, Stephanie. It was the first time she's gotten to meet a listener. Yeah, I don't think I had her with me when I met Sunshine, who was the first listener that I met. So she did get to meet Stephanie, and that, in some weird indirect route, ended up opening some conversations about how much we all need each other for support and community and connection and mental health. And that is gonna kind of be part of the theme next week. So I think that I'm going to let that be my segue into next week.
I think that's perfect and beautiful. Yeah. I love our community. I love our family. Me too.
Me too. I don't know how I feel about Riley anymore now that Riley's the reason I did this episode, but she might be fired, demoted for a week or so. I'm just kidding. I'm so kidding. However, this episode really did a fucking number on me. And don't worry. None of this is like a problematic trigger for me. It's just, do you see what I mean? That she's somebody that you would know?
Yes.
Yeah. And there are so many
things. But isn't that the truth? It's always somebody knows someone.
It is. It is. And it, but it's like if there's so much, you know, maybe she would have had in 2024, she would have had more access to information about her potential fertility. She would have, you know, if she was ace, that would have been a thing that had a name. Mm-hmm. Other than just weird and different, and that she may have been able to find community there if that's something that she, which she may not have been at all. I think it's hard to say that the movie is not meant to be taken that way, but who knows about the real woman. But there's just so much that I wish she would have lived in our lifetime.
Yeah.
So we're going to pick that back up next week, and that is where I leave you.
All right. Well, until then. Sweet dreams or no dreams.
Sweet dreams or no dreams.
Hey, Horrible Ghouls. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you would like to share your personal MarkSafe moment, you can send it to us at MarkSafePodcast@gmail.com. Please give our podcast a rate, review, and subscribe, and tell your buddies about us too. That goes a long way. If you want to further elevate your support, check out our MarkSafe Patreon page, where we have shoutouts, goodies, and some bonus content in the works. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again, and as always, stay safe.